the spotlight.
It is the anniversary of the Iran nuclear deal, otherwise known as the JCPOA, but it is not a time to celebrate. After weeks of talks in Vienna, the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions, as Iran has demanded. This not only jeopardizes the outcome of the talks, but leads Iran to conclude that the U.S., headed by President Joe Biden, still believes the maximum pressure campaign actually works.
It was July 14, 2015, that Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the US, France, Britain, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The agreement was later endorsed by the United Nations Security Council with Resolution 2231. Based on the accord signed during the administration of then US President Barack Obama, Iran undertook to put limits on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of nuclear-related sanctions imposed on the country. Following the enforcement of the pact in January 2016, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed for 15 times in its reports, in a span over 3 years, that Tehran fully implemented its commitments under the deal. But in May 2018, Obama's successor, Donald Trump, unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which spotlighted Tehran's mistrust of Washington. 1 year after Washington's pullout of the JCPOA, Iran began to roll back its commitments as the remaining signatories failed to secure its interests under the deal. Nonetheless, the administration of Joe Biden expressed readiness to re-enter the JCPOA, which paved the way for Iran and the remaining signatories to hold several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital to revive the deal. Iran has stressed that the deal cannot be revived unless the U.S. removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. It has also insisted on a guarantee by the U.S. to not renege on the accord again in the future. Despite the Biden administration's willingness to restore the JCPOA, it has taken no concrete measures to that direction so far. Now, on the sixth signing anniversary of the landmark agreement, Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue its pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse its course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
I guess joining us for this edition of The Debate, Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joins us from Budapest. Also joining us, political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran, Sayed Mohammad Mirandi, who joins us. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me start with you, Professor Mirandi, if I may. We're looking at the JCPOA anniversary, which should be a joyous occasion, but the U.S. pulled out of the deal. It has incurred billions of dollars of damage to Iran's economy. So this, in a sense, should be a day where the U.S. should be held responsible to pay for these damages. What are your views when you take a look at this anniversary in terms of what it marks and what it signifies?
I think it not only exposes the real nature of the U.S. government, but it also exposes the nature of Western governments, the Western media, the Western political establishment, and that is that none of them can be trusted. The United States, as we speak, continues to impose maximum pressure sanctions. They have no intention so far to implement the nuclear deal. And the Europeans are siding with the Americans. And the Western media behaves as if the United States is not to blame. The United States under Obama, when they signed the deal, they failed even back then to abide by their commitments, and then under Trump they left the deal completely. The maximum pressure campaign, of course, was barbaric under Trump, but we have to also keep in mind that the whole notion of this maximum pressure campaign was Obama's. It was Biden and Obama that began targeting women and children to gain concessions from Iran. And ultimately, when they saw that Iran wouldn't bend the knee. Obama sent a message to Iran basically implying that he'll accept Iran's right to enrich uranium, and then the negotiations began. And then after, of course, President Rouhani won the election, we had a new type of negotiations, the P5 plus one, and Iran, and we had the deal. But the point is that U.S. behavior has been inhumane from the beginning. The United States never abided by its own commitments, whether under Democrats or Republicans. The Iranians did abide by their commitments, yet the Western media continues to depict Iran as the problem. Not only should Western countries be abiding by their commitments right now, but they should be compensating for the deaths and the destruction that has been carried out as a result of their violations over the last few years. Yet what we're seeing instead is Western governments continuing with the maximum pressure campaign so that they can get additional concessions from Iran. They have no intention of implementing the deal in full as we speak. I should stress, and that's something that would, in an insane world, be extraordinary. But for us, it's nothing unexpected.
First time, really, something that many don't recall, or that it wasn't highlighted, even though it was very evident, and it became very evident, was back in the time when the deal was signed. Lots of optimism, obviously, because of the signature, showing that diplomacy works. But then when it actually came to the execution part, in order for Iran to reap the benefits, it was becoming increasingly clear that that wasn't happening. People were afraid, countries were afraid to invest in Iran because they said at some point or another, U.S. sanctions would bite. And many of these large companies and conglomerates, well, they had centers or franchises in the U.S. So when the money was to make its way around, they were afraid that somewhere along the line, the U.S. Treasury, for example, would jump on that. So this deal really did not even evolve or to come into fruition for Iran, did it?
That's absolutely right. It was already stated within the JCPOA itself the likelihood of the United States withdrawing. I mean, in other words, it was already envisaged that the United States would one day withdraw, and that's why the other members of the JCPOA made their commitments that if the United States withdraws and reimposes sanctions, they will alleviate the pain that Iran would suffer as a result of their reimposed sanctions. That, of course, never happened. But it's clear that right there, even as they were negotiating, it was always on the cards that the United States would withdraw. And the United States never ratified the JCPOA, and so therefore, it was inevitable that the next man in after Obama would simply walk away, given the extent of the hostility toward Iran that is shared all across the political spectrum in the United States. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump, Donald Trump is a very controversial political figure, to say the least, in the United States. Many of his statements and his policies arouse a lot of rancor in the United States. The one policy that doesn't arouse rancor is his policy toward Iran. Yeah, that's passed, you know, without any problems. His assassination, illegal assassination of General Soleimani, that went by the board. You know, no one objected too much to that. So again, you know, now that we're having these negotiations in Vienna, we've already had six rounds. You know, you look around and say, the Biden administration has no particular political need to do anything for Iran. It has very limited political capital at home. It will only incur unpopularity, obviously, among the Republicans, but it will also incur a considerable amount of unpopularity even among Democrats. So that's why it's essentially been stalling, kicking the can down the road. We've had these six rounds of talks, now we're going to have a seventh round of talks, but it's made no real decision, no real commitment to return to the JCPOA.
Well, not to drag out the past, but Professor Morandi, I need to touch on this because it's rather important the way that the EU through the E3 played its role, which was very striking the way that the EU had to come out and say we can't force companies to do business with Iran or not. But they actually came out with a handbook, I think, explaining to these companies that, you know, it's okay to do business. And then they came out with this Instex. But nothing panned out. How do you assess the European role during that time?
I think we first have to go back to the Obama years. And after the signing of the nuclear deal, almost a year after the deal was signed, the head of the Iranian Central Bank said in Washington, if I'm not mistaken, that nothing has changed. In other words, Obama never intended to implement the deal, let alone the EU three countries. They had no intention of doing anything for Iran. They were basically trying to buy time to keep Iran implementing the deal. They knew from the start they weren't going to do anything. After Obama signed the deal, a series of senior banking officials from Europe came to Iran, and they wanted to see me. So they came to my office, and they told me very explicitly that we are very interested in working in Iran. Important banks, if I name them, they're relatively well known. They said, we want to work in Iran, but the Americans have told us through back channels that if you go to Iran, we will punish you. This was after the deal was signed. This was under the Obama regime. This was not during Trump. When Trump left the deal and imposed maximum pressure, the Europeans never intended to do anything about it. All they wanted to do was to keep Iran in the deal, so that on the one hand, the Europeans would be imposing Trump sanctions against Iran, and Iran would be keeping its own hands tied. And Iran actually did that for a year, not because the Europeans wanted it, but the Iranians calculated that if they continue to implement the deal for a year or an extended period of time, it would make the United States look very bad. Whereas if the Iranians had left the deal right after the United States, we all know how the Western media works. Iran would be blamed. The Western media would ignore Trump and attack Iran, even though it was obvious that Trump was the problem. So the Iranians waited a year, continued to implement the deal, and then only after a year, in five steps, as you know, every 2 months, Iran began to decrease its commitments. And then after 2 years, almost 2 years, Iran was carrying out minimal commitments, let's say 30-40% of its commitments. It's, you know, debatable. It's subjective how to put a percentage on it. And then only a few months ago, as you recall, as we all recall, that the Iranian parliament passed a law where the Iranians discontinued its implementation of the deal. So the Europeans never intended to abide by the deal. The Americans never intended to abide by the deal. And right now, the Europeans and the Americans do not intend to abide by the deal.
Well, that obviously raises the question, to follow up on what just Professor Morandi said there, George Samuelli, then why are the parties hashing out whatever it is that they're hashing out?
Well, I think they want to somehow lock Iran into the deal without their actually making any commitments themselves. And Biden did make a variety of promises during the election. I never took these promises seriously. They always seemed to be hedged and evasive, and people were eager. There were, you know, Washington pundits were absolutely insistent that, oh, Biden will return to the JCPOA. He's absolutely determined to do it. It was always nonsensical, and that he was always extraordinarily evasive. But the point is that by keeping the negotiations going and then nothing would come out of it, it's a way of making sure that Iran will take the blame for any, basically, you know, failure to come to an agreement. Well, we bent backwards. We stretched out our hand. You know, we did what we could. We went the extra mile, but the Iranians were just so absolutely unreasonable. What can you expect? So I think a lot of it is just a lot of play acting in order to provide for the Americans kind of a face-saving formula.
Well, I do have to bring in what Zarif has said on his Twitter account, and I'd like to get your reaction on this, Professor Marandi, out of respect, if anything. And him saying 6 years ago today, JCPOA received the UNSC Chapter 6 issue without resorting to war. Obama realized his crippling sanctions would not cripple Iran or its centrifuges. Trump ineptly thought maximum pressure would. It never will. I'm sure you've read this tweet by Zarif. What do you think?
That's it's complicated. I was never for or against the nuclear deal. I thought we could have negotiated better. The reason why we didn't negotiate better is very complicated, and I don't want to go into that right now. But I was always skeptical, and I was in Vienna at the time, and I told Dr. Zetti that I don't think the Americans will implement the deal. And as we speak, I don't believe we should leave the deal. I think Iran should remain within the deal, but I think Iran's current policy is an appropriate one. The Iranians are pursuing their nuclear program. They're expanding the nuclear program. That's how they gain leverage. And I don't think it should be the Iranians to exit the deal. If anyone's going to exit it, we should let the other side do it. But in order to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans recognize that Iran is not going to wait forever, I think there should be a policy change. And this is where I think the previous administration or the outgoing administration made a mistake. I think the new administration should tilt away from Europe and the United States. We should explore better relations with China, with Russia, with Asia, with the Global South, with regional countries and neighboring countries. They should be our priority. If the Europeans and the Americans want to come back to the table, if they want to come to their senses and implement the deal, fine. I'm not saying that we should break off ties with the Europeans in any way or form. But I'm saying that we should give them a clear message that we're not going to wait anymore, and that we're going to engage with those countries that keep their doors open. And if they want to open their doors later on, that's fine. But we can no longer wait. And at the same time, I think that the Iranians are doing the right thing. I think the Iranian parliament passed a more or less good law where the Iranians will fulfill all of their obligations, or let's say they will expand their nuclear program and implement their right to have an extensive peaceful nuclear program within the framework of the NPT and the IAEA. And the regulations in NPT and the IAEA allow Iran to do many things. And I think Iran should explore all of them to the fullest. Mm-hmm. To make the Americans and the Europeans feel the pressure.
Okay. Well, George Samueli, I'm going to get back to you on and test you on some of the things you just said there. But after I asked George Samueli this, George Samueli, we've had some exposure towards the incoming new administration headed by Seyed Ebrahim Raisi. And he has said, you know what, okay, we can continue the talks. But he said that this is not going to make or break Iran. If the U.S. Eventually pulls through, great. If not, Iran's going to move on. Do you get that impression?
I do get that impression, and I concur with Professor Miranda's assessment. I mean, it's understandable that Iran wants the U.S. sanctions lifted, but I think it's a hopeless endeavor dealing with the United States. What is important is that the United Nations Security Council sanctions have gone, and they're not coming back, and therefore Iran has a lot more room to maneuver than it did have a decade ago, because as long as it is building a peaceful nuclear energy program within the parameters of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and as long as it's cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Authority, then it's going to have good trading relations with Russia, it's going to have good trading and relations with China, and therefore the whole dollar-denominated trading system, which was so painful to Iran, is going to become much less important. Russia is moving away from the dollar, the Chinese are moving away from the dollar, and so Iran will be able to conduct oil trade, without reliance on the dollar.
Okay, so my final question goes to you, Professor Morandi. I don't know if you remember, Joe Biden was almost boarding a plane. And that was when the news came out that Iran signed that deal with China, that big deal. And when the reporter asked him about that, he was very angry. when he responded, yeah, this was in the works and I knew it would happen. Do you think that the U.S. does not, or one of the incentives it has, is it does not want Iran to gravitate towards China in the former manner that that deal showed that it was going to, along with Russia, I'm assuming, and for this to be an incentive for the U.S. to actually want to have a deal with Iran?
The United States can't have its cake and eat it too. On the one hand, they want to impose maximum pressure on Iran, and they want Iran to sit quiet. They also impose sanctions and economic warfare on China, and they want China not to tilt towards Iran. And they impose sanctions on Russia, and they want Russia just to stand still. That's not going to happen, especially because the world is changing very rapidly. Western countries are on the decline. There's no doubt about that. I'm not saying that Western countries have no influence, but relatively speaking, they are on the decline. And by putting pressure on Iran, Russia, and China, they are creating a greater incentive for them to work towards each other. And I think it's the smart thing to do. These countries have a vested interest in making sure that the United States fails in its economic warfare. Because if the United States succeeds against Russia, that's a success against everyone. If the United States fails against Iran, that's a failure in its economic warfare against all countries. So it's smart for Iran to have good ties with all countries that want to have good ties with Iran. And if the United States and the Europeans come to their senses, so much the better. But if they don't want to come to their senses, then Iran, while maintaining its independence, Iran is fiercely independent, it will engage in the best of relations with those countries that want to have excellent relations with Iran.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. That's Sayyid Mohammad Marandi, professor at the University of Tehran. Thank you for your contribution.
Thank you.
And also senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Damiali from Budapest. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in from Mikhail Tahway, entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.
If you ask me, why do I stand here so unafraid of everything around me? Proudly I would say, I am a Muslim. If you ask her, why does she dress that way, all covered up in a world that gives it all away? Proudly she would say, I am a Muslim.
Islamic laws.
If you ask him, why does he still pray 5 times a day when so many others have strayed? Smiling, he would say, I am a Muslim.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of God. Welcome to the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio with me, Muhammad Javad, hosting this program. And sitting in the studio along with me, Sheikh Javid, well, the dear guest speaker in this program, Islamic Laws. Welcome to the program, Sheikh Javid.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
The pleasure is ours. Stay tuned. We'll be back. We're going to talk about the laws of divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's fatwas. Before that, let's take a listen to a short biography.
The Grand Ayatollah Sistani comes from the family of scholars and pious men. He learned theological and rational sciences from many eminent and well-known religious scholars. At the age of 5, His Eminence started learning the Holy Quran. He was then admitted in a religious center for reading, writing, and for learning basic mathematics and geography. In the beginning of 1360 Hijri, he started studying basic Hausa lessons. He also studied a number of books on philosophy like Sharh Manzuma Sabzawari and Sharh Ashraq. Meanwhile, he attended Kharij lectures by the late Mirza Mehdi Ashtiani and the late Mirza Hashim Qazvini. In the late 1368 Hijri, he migrated to Qum to accomplish his studies in fiqh and usul. His eminence left Qum for Najaf al-Ashraf. On having arrived in Najaf, he began attending Qayatullah Khoi and Sheikh Hussain Halli's lectures in jurisprudence and the fundamentals of jurisprudence. In 1380 Hijri, Ayatollah Sistani traveled back to his hometown, the holy city of Mashhad, expecting to stay and settle down there. In the same year, he was awarded a permit by Imam Al-Khoi and another by Sheikh Halli, certifying that he had attained the level of ijtihad, that is, deduction of legal judgment in matters of religion.
Well, Sheikh Javid, let's talk about the divorce according to Ayatollah Sistani's laws and fatwas. And in the last episode, I asked you about the civil divorce, whether it is valid or not. And you said, no, we have to differentiate between the civil laws and ritual laws. Let me start this episode with this question. You know, we know that, you know, before a divorce, a genuine divorce to happen, usually there is an emotional breakup.
Sure.
All right?
Yes.
And the couples usually separate for a while, and then they go to the ceremonies, like, I mean, the formalities of the laws, and they get their divorce officially. But if that is the case, if the couple separate for a couple of months, let's say 6 months, right?
Or even 6 years.
Or even years, yes.
Yes.
All right? Would that be considered as a divorce, or there would be no need actually for a divorce for them to pursue?
Well, there are people out there who are under the impression that when a husband and his wife separate from each other for a long time, let's say 6 months or 6 years or more or less, okay, then their marriage is automatically
void,
nullified, actually, and they are no longer considered to be husband and wife to each other. This is a kind of, this is just in a general understanding, but it is not based on any valid reasons or any concrete or solid arguments. Nothing is there to support this notion. According to Islamic Sharia, in order for a divorce to be valid, there are certain conditions to be met, and of course, as we promised, we will inshallah discuss this. But it is wrong to believe that a long separation that takes place between a husband and wife will ultimately, or at the end of the day, will terminate their relationship forever, and in such a way that they will not be considered husband and wife. That's not actually the case.
I see. Thank you for that, Sheikh Tobi. What is the status of the divorce where a husband's signature is forged on the divorce paper, on the divorce permit or document? Is the divorce valid then?
Well, many such questions do come to the offices of the religious authorities, with some people asking that, okay, I never consented to a divorce, and my, for example, signature has been forged by some people. I have never been there to give my consent or permission for divorce. And of course, such cases do happen, especially in countries like Indian subcontinent, Pakistan, Bangladesh, in such places. Such forgery does take place, unfortunately. And the truth of the matter is that fabrication of documents or forging signatures do not have any impact on the truth, on the relationship between the husband and wife. They remain and they continue to remain husband and wife. That forgery will not impact or affect their relationship.
The Office of Ayatollah Sistani is currently providing the following services. 1. Board of Istifta, replying to religious questions. 2. Helping the poor, needy, homeless, and those who have suffered losses by earthquakes and floods. 3. Sending books for people who want to understand and learn Islam. 4. Hajj delegation. 5. Sending preachers. Board of Istifta is a link between Ayatollah Sistani and people. It provides them with answers to questions pertaining to religious, ideological, social, and educational matters in accordance with the verdicts and rulings of Ayatollah Sistani. For more information, visit the website of Ayatollah Sistani at www.sistani.org. You can also ask your questions through the following email, english@sistani.org.
Usually, even in the eyes of law, forgery is considered illegal and
sure.
It doesn't hold any value.
Definitely.
All right. What about a situation where we know that in lots of Eastern countries, as opposed to the Western countries, where the couple decide on their own to marry or divorce? But usually we see that in lots of other countries, especially in the East, as I've mentioned earlier, that the parents also have a say in whatsoever these rituals are,
mm-hmm.
Because of their emotional attachment, probably.
Yes.
All right? Imagine a situation where a man's parents want him to divorce his wife.
Yeah.
All right, but he himself doesn't want that to happen.
Yeah.
He doesn't want to divorce her.
Sure,
his wife. All right, what would that situation be? And should he obey his parents' commands to divorce her, or keep living with her?
Yes, it's just like being between a rock and a hard, you know.
Yes.
Wall, or there is a saying in English.
Yes.
Because one has to either choose between obeying his parents, or hurting them, and keeping his wife. You know. Mm-hmm. Of course, the parents have no right and no authority to compel their son to divorce his wife. You know. In such cases, the son has to decide independently or without even listening to his parents, because maybe his wife is not compatible with his parents, and it is actually his responsibility to provide his wife with a separate place of residence, a separate accommodation, or something, so that she may have
mm-hmm.
actually peace of mind, and she may have her privacy. And of course, in an extended family, the wife usually does not have that privacy. She has to observe hijab because her cousins are there, uncles are there, and everyone has actually has a say in the decisions made in that extended family. And therefore, unfortunately, in such families, the wife's right is usually violated.
Mm-hmm.
It is actually the responsibility of the husband to provide his wife with a separate place, even if he may have to rent or rent a place or leave as a tenant, or he has to go to a great deal actually to buy a house. Mm-hmm. Okay. In any case, it is
a must.
It is a must. It is his legal duty. But if he does not and he cannot do so, and his parents is now actually picking feud with his wife, every day there's a quarrel, there's a dispute, and there is actually fight going on between the wife and his parents. His parents does not like for example their daughter-in-law,
mm-hmm.
while her husband wants his wife. In such cases, the husband should never listen to his parents. He should not listen. He should not obey his parents, and he should keep his wife. He should protect his marriage. He should do whatever he can to actually to save his marriage. Of course. He has to support his wife especially in such a setting, in such a crowded
mm-hmm.
Environment or family.
So if the husband listens to his parents and divorces his wife, will it be considered a sin, or it's haram actually to do so?
It is not haram to divorce one's wife, but it's highly despicable
mm-hmm.
and it is discouraged. You know, talaq or divorce is the most hated or the most despicable halal action,
mm-hmm.
you know. And the Islamic Sharia allows a man to divorce his wife,
mm-hmm.
but at the same time, he is dissuaded
mm-hmm.
and discouraged from taking such action.
I see.
It is said that divorce is a solution. It is a lost resort. It's the lost solution when there's no other solution, no other way out left.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Javid. That was the program Islamic Laws on RIB English Radio. Thank you very much for listening to us. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The world with reporters.
The Iranian government has expressed anger over the participation of Italian politician Franco Frattini to a hybrid virtual and face-to-face meeting hosted by terror organization MKO in Albania last weekend. MKO is seen by geopolitical experts as a dangerous sectarian group that was on the list of terrorist organizations of the EU and the US for several years, Despite that, a number of international figures, including former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo and former Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper, have given their full support for this group.
The truth is that the MKO has always been instrumental to the geopolitical strategies of Western countries. It's been designated as a terrorist organization for many years, and its delisting was very much linked to a plan to increase pressure on Tehran. This only shows the double standards of the West when it comes to terrorist groups. MKO's collusion with the US and the Israeli intelligence is a known fact.
Frattini is a former European commissioner and foreign minister under two Berlusconi governments between 2002 and 2011. As the head of Italy's foreign affairs, in 2003 he sent an Italian military and police contingent to Iraq and Afghanistan in support of the US hegemonic influence in the Middle East. Frattini currently holds the post of director of the prestigious Italian Society for International Organization, a non-profit body operating under the supervision of the Italian Ministry of Foreign Affairs. Contacted by Press TV, the former Italian minister has declined to comment on its appearance at the MKO event held in Albania.
Frattini's participation in the MKO's annual conference comes as no surprise. Some governments interacting with terrorist organizations to avoid boots-on-the-ground combat operation need well-known political figures who support them to validate their illegal actions.
Iran has summoned the ambassador of Slovenia to Tehran to voice protest at the Slovenian Prime Minister Janez Janša's participation in the anti-Iran virtual gathering organized by the MKO. In an official letter of protest, Tehran has called the Slovenian Prime Minister's move unacceptable and undiplomatic.
Ties between Italy and Iran have been forever connoted by consistent mutual empathy, to the point that not even the US unilaterally imposed sanctions completely stop their relations. Rome has long been Tehran's main trade partner, and hundreds of Italian companies are looking forward to fully resuming trade with Iran. Max Civili, Rome.
A Yemeni rights advocacy group called the Eye of Humanity Center for Rights and Development has released a new report. It highlights the destruction of Yemen's infrastructure in over 6 years of war by Saudi Arabia and some of its regional allies.
The bombardment of civilian areas by the Saudi-led coalition's warplanes and artillery units have turned more than 500,000 homes into ruin. The attacks have also targeted 15 airports across Yemen, turning them non-operational. The seaports in the impoverished country, which are the only lifeline for people, have not been spared either. 16 Yemeni ports have been damaged in the coalition airstrikes. The ongoing Saudi-led military campaign has also resulted in the total or partial destruction of 391 hospitals or health facilities.
An important part of the report also highlights the number of victims of the Saudi-led war. The advocacy group says more than 43,000 Yemenis have been either killed or injured in the conflict.
17,176 people have been killed in Saudi-led attacks on Yemen. These include more than 3,800 children and 2,400 women. 26,700 people have also been wounded. These include over 4,200 children and 2,800 women.
Children have sustained a significant number of casualties in Saudi-led attacks. Yet the United Nations last month, in a controversial move, added Yemen's Ansarullah movement to its 2021 list of violators of children's rights. That sparked condemnations with Yemen's political leadership, saying that such a move by the world body is detached from realities on the ground and is not based on independent reports. Last year, the UN removed the Saudi-led coalition from the list of shame, an annual blacklist of parties violating children's rights. That despite the UN's own investigators found the coalition of killing or injuring hundreds of children in its relentless bombing campaign on the impoverished nation. Saudi Arabia was first included on the blacklist in 2016, but the decision was reversed shortly after the kingdom threatened to cut off funding to UN programs. The UN this year excluded Saudi Arabia from the list not to antagonize the kingdom again. Riyadh, along with some of its allies and backed by the West, has been bombing Yemen since 2015. It has also imposed an all-out blockade on the country. These have resulted in the world's biggest humanitarian crisis in Yemen, where 2 in 3 people, according to the UN, need help to survive, and children are dying from entirely preventable causes in their thousands. According to Yemen's health ministry, at least one child dies every 5 minutes as a result of Saudi siege or attacks. The extent of casualties and damage reveals the brutality of the Saudi-led coalition toward Yemen. Still, the West and the UN continue to show their double standard when it comes to Yemen and embolden Saudi Arabia to continue committing crimes. It seems what matters the most is Saudi petrodollars, not the loss of innocent human lives.
Haiti's president, Jovenel Moïse, was killed during an attack on his private residence in the capital, Port-au-Prince, last Wednesday. No guard was injured in the attack. Officials have not yet explained how the killers got past Moïse's security detail. They have not said anything about the possible motive behind the assassination either. Haitian police say 28 people were involved in the attack. 3 are Haitian Americans who have been arrested. The rest, all Colombian, remain at large. The Colombian Defense Ministry says initial findings suggest that several of the attackers have been retired members of the Colombian military. On Monday, Haitian police said they had caught the mastermind behind the assassination. They said the suspect had used a Florida-based security firm to hire mercenaries to kill the president. Washington has said the evidence provided by the Haitian authorities indicates that the assassination plot was at least partly hatched in the United States. Meanwhile, American television CNN said several of the men involved in Moïse's assassination were previously working as U.S. law enforcement informants. CNN cited people briefed on the matter. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration told it that at least one of the arrested suspects was a confidential source to the administration. Other suspects also had U.S. ties, including working as informants for the FBI. However, the FBI said in response to CNN's reporting that it doesn't comment on informants. A simple history check reveals deep U.S. involvement in Haiti. In 1915, following the assassination of the then-Haitian president, the U.S. sent Marines into the tiny island nation. Washington gained complete control over the Haitian finances and the right to intervene there whenever the U.S. government deemed it necessary. This occupation continued until 1934. With Haiti having a track record of interference from Western governments like the U.S., it remains to be seen whether the country will be able to preserve peace and stability as it goes through this transformation.
Disgusting scenes coincided with England's historic defeat against Italy in the Euro 2020 football competition, as fights, vandalism and racism were recorded both before and after full time. The majority of the racism was online and aimed at 3 black players who failed to score vital penalty kicks, costing England the game. The flood of hate forced even the Prime Minister to speak out against it.
Major clean-up operations taking place just outside Wembley Stadium after the scenes we saw. Many would have hoped that we would have seen an end to hooliganism in the football industry. It was once dubbed the English disease, but it appears after the scenes we saw yesterday that we have some way to go before we can class the English disease as being totally extinct from the industry.
Footage recorded outside the stadium showed mobs of ticketless fans storm past the gates, gaining illegal entry, only to be met by a rival mob of fans fighting to keep them out. While the once clean streets of central London was turned into a giant rubbish tip by frustrated fans lashing out.
The reaction from England fans was both entirely predictable and in keeping with long-standing English traditions of extreme violence and disorder upon defeat. I mean, to support England means to support this sort of behaviour. I think it's an essential part of the supporter culture of the national team. You know, you can't really get more English than spiteful violence to make up for one's own deficiencies. The authorities don't exist to protect minorities, but to punish us. And what I found more disturbing was the number of black and brown people supporting England, you know, out of ignorance, a misplaced sense of identity, self-hatred. This should be a wake-up call for them.
These actions have now led to a Football Association review of England's conduct and condemnation by the London Metropolitan Police. However, if fans can't be properly held in check, England could risk major fines or even be banned from competing in the future. Robert Carter, London. Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the US and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative, requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered. Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Puriza, London.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions within the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
Kabul Bagram Highway, and we are on our way to Bagram District in northern Parwan province to visit Bagram Airfield. The 70 hectares airfield was known as the symbol of the U.S. military power in Afghanistan before its withdrawal from this key site. Now, Bagram Military Air Base, which was known as an American town in Afghanistan, is handed over to Afghan National Army, and the government says having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban. But as this army general says, the government needs more time to either collect all remaining tools, vehicles and other facilities or deploy military forces in Bagram.
Working group are continuing their work inside the Bagram. We don't want to lose the facilities which left by the American forces here. We are assured that we try to use all the facilities. In the future, some of the maybe Air Force branch will deploy here, but the priority right now to secure the area.
We got permission to see some insider parts of the airfield. The first destination is parking lot, where the U.S. forces left their military vehicles. Then we visited the Bagram Hospital. Officials say they are working to make it operational very soon.
The Health Affairs Department of the Ministry of Defense has planned to make this hospital in Bagram operational. That is why we are here working on the plan despite some problems like shortage of power and some administrative issues.
One of the other places to visit is the residential area, but when we were heading to this site, we faced many hideouts being used to protect U.S. forces from possible Taliban rocket attacks. However, it seems U.S. forces have even left their boots behind due to a hurry to leave this largest military base in Afghanistan. Bagram Military Airfield was considered as one of the strategic bases across Afghanistan not only during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, but even earlier during the Soviet Union occupation of the country. Now, the Afghan government should decide how to protect this vast base and deploy Afghan forces here, Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province.
After 2 months of digging into a depth of more than 20 meters, Yemen's Mine Action Center managed to defuse one of the largest U.S. bombs dropped in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bomb was expected to target the civil defense building in Sana'a.
This GBU-24 bomb from the Paperboy series was dropped in 2015 to target the civilian defense building in Sana'a next to Al Thara Park and Al Hasaba local market. The Saudi-led coalition has been using various types of advanced American weapons in its war on Yemen. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Observers say this bomb is another proof of the U.S. military support for the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen.
We defused a GBU-24 bomb with a weight of 1.5 tons. The bomb targeted this hangar designated for the maintenance of Yemeni civil defensive fire trucks. The explosion of the bomb could have caused a humanitarian catastrophe with great consequences. The U.S. has provided only a few countries, including Saudi Arabia, with such a bomb.
Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the country. Back in April 2015, Riyadh committed one unforgettable crime by bombing the Attan area with a U.S. cluster bomb, killing more than 100 civilians, including women and children.
This American bomb dropped by U.S. aircraft is yet another witness to Washington's role in the war crimes in Yemen, as the U.N. turns a blind eye to such violations. Besides the military support, Yemenis say Washington has always been backing Saudi Arabia politically as a major ally in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Security situation is deteriorating day by day in Afghanistan due to the rising Taliban.